Hi, I'm Diane Lucas.
And this is Mick, the Doctor of Digital.
And welcome to Music 101. Music 101 is created to empower music itself, and legendary icon in the music industry. Another week, another great episode. The art of the opening track, 1970s rock's most explosive album starters.
Yep, indeed. There's something magical about dropping a needle on a new record and hearing that first track explode from the speakers. Before the snap, crackle, pop of wearing out an LP, as the 70s album became artistic statements rather than just collection of singles, the opening track carried enormous weight. It set the tone, established the mood, and told you exactly what kind of journey you were about to take. The best opening tracks from that decade didn't just introduce albums. They kicked down doors, grabbed you by the collar, and refused to let go. From the Stones' controversial Swagger to Led Zeppelin's Final Guitar Symphony, these songs represent rock and roll at its most confident, most dangerous, and most vital. Today, we're exploring the greatest opening salvos from 1970s rock albums, tracks that announce their presence with authority and remain powerful statements half a century later.
Yes, indeed. And thank you so much for the 70s rocks, because until now, we're still talking about. Thank you for your legacy. So, Mr. Mick, let's start with one of the most controversial opening tracks of the era. What made Brown Sugar such a powerful way to open Sticky Fingers?
Well, Brown Sugar kicked off the Rolling Stones' 1971 masterpiece Sticky Fingers with an audacity that still feels shocking today. This wasn't just a great rock song. It was deliberate provocation, a hard rock sexual tour wrapped in racial and historical imagery that pushed every boundary the early 70s had to offer. The song opens with that instantly recognizable guitar riff from Keith Richards, a descending pattern that sounds like trouble walking down the stairs. And from the first note, you know the Stones aren't interested in playing it safe. What made this such an effective album opener was its sheer confidence. The Stones had just ended their relationship with their former manager and were essentially declaring independence with their own label, Rolling Stones Records. They needed to make a statement, and Brown Sugar delivered that statement with a sledgehammer. The song tackles slavery, interracial sex, drug use, and sadomasochism, subjects that were guaranteed to generate controversy, but does so with such raw musical power that it became a massive hit anyway, reaching number one in the United States and becoming one of their most enduring concert staples. The production, handled by Jimmy Miller, gives the track a swampy, bottom-heavy groove that was perfect for the emerging FM radio format, where album tracks could breathe. Charlie Watts' drumming pushes and pulls at the beat, creating a tension that never quite resolves, while Mick Jagger's vocals alternate between a sneer and a howl. The backup singers add gospel influence calls and responses, creating this fascinating tension between the sacred and the profane that the Stones had been exploring throughout their career. Critics at the time were divided. Some praised its raw energy, while others condemned its subject matter, but the song's impact was undeniable. Looking back from today's perspective, the lyrical content might be lamented by the woke crowd, but it deals with slavery and racial dynamics in ways that were fine for us back in the day. But now it makes modern listeners uncomfortable. As an opening track, Brown Sugar told you everything you needed to know about Sticky Fingers. This was going to be raw, real, uncomfortable, and essential. The song's cultural impact extended beyond the album itself to become a blueprint for how rock bands could address controversial subjects through musical swagger rather than political correctness. Bring back the 70s. In conclusion, Brown Sugar demonstrated that opening tracks could be confrontational rather than inviting, establishing a tone of danger and controversy that made everything that followed feel more urgent and alive.
Moving from controversy to pure pop craftsmanship, how did Band on the Run work as the opening track?
Paul McCartney's title track from his 1973 Band on the Run represents the polar opposite from the Stones. Instead of provocation, McCartney offered pure pop accessibility wrapped in the most Beatlesque music any former Beatle had produced since the breakup. This song is essentially three different songs stitched together seamlessly, moving through distinct sections that take you on a complete emotional journey in just over 5 minutes. The opening is deliberately ominous, with McCartney singing about being stuck in prison, creating tension and unease. Then the song explodes into its main section with that instantly memorable guitar riff and the line, "Band on the run, band on the run," transforming from claustrophobia to freedom in a single musical moment. Finally, it shifts into a triumphant finale that feels like pure celebration. As an album opener, this structural ambition told listeners they were getting something substantial, not just a collection of 3-minute pop songs. McCartney's layered vocals and instruments were treated with meticulous care, creating a rich, full production that rivaled anything he'd done with the Beatles. The guitar solo that erupts in the middle section, played by McCartney himself, has that melodic quality that characterized his best work. It's not just technical display, it's a sing-along melody that lodges in your memory. The song became a massive hit, reaching number one in the United States in 1974 and essentially reestablishing McCartney as a serious artist after a few years of lighter, less ambitious solo work. Critics who dismissed him as the lightweight Beatle, especially compared to John Lennon's more politically conscious solo material, had to reconsider after Band on the Run. The album went on to win Grammy for Best Pop Vocal Performance and sold over 6 million copies. What made Band on the Run work so effectively as an opening track was how it demonstrated ambition without pretension. In conclusion, Band on the Run proved that opening tracks could be ambitious and accessible simultaneously, creating compositional sophistication wrapped in immediately appealing pop melodies that invited repeated listening.
Mr. Merrick, Mudd Hoople is not as universally known as the Stones or McCartney, but you called all the way from Memphis one of these 70s best opening tracks. What makes it special?
Well, obviously it's special to me as a huge Mott the Hoople fan and having written a book on former lead singer Ian Hunter, but it's a great track for several reasons. All the Way from Memphis was Mott the Hoople's 1973 self-titled album, represents everything that made 70s rock exciting. It's theatrical without being pretentious, tough without being macho, and literate without being inaccessible. Ian Hunter's raspy vocal delivery immediately establishes personality, while Mick Ralph's guitar work provides a melodic foundation that's both sophisticated and visceral. But what really elevates this track is the contribution of Andy McKay from Roxy Music, whose saxophone adds a layer of glamorous decadence that transformed the song from a straightforward rock into something more complex and textured. The song tells the story of a rock and roll pilgrim's journey, someone who's traveled all the way from Memphis, the birthplace of rock and roll, only to have their radio stolen, their singular connection to the music they love. It's a brilliant metaphor for the vulnerability of artistic passion, how the things that matter most to us can be taken away arbitrarily, leaving us diminished. Hunter sings these lyrics with a combination of world weariness and defiant hope that captures the contradictions of being a working musician in the early 70s, when the idealism of the 60s had curdled, but the love of music remained. As an opening track, All the Way from Memphis accomplished something crucial for Mott the Hoople. It established them as more than just the man David Bowie rescued from obscurity. Bowie had written and produced their breakthrough hit, All the Way from All the Young Dudes, the previous year, which gave them credibility and commercial success, but also risk defining them as Bowie's creation rather than artists in their own right. By opening their next album with this original composition that showcased their own songwriting and arranging talents, they asserted independence while maintaining the rocking aesthetic that made them relevant. The production, handled by the band along with the engineer, captures the live energy that made Mott the Hoople such an exciting concert act. There's a looseness to the performance that prevents it from feeling overproduced or sterile, qualities that plague some rock records that prioritize studio trickery over genuine musical communication. When McKay's saxophone enters during the instrumental breaks, it doesn't feel like a gimmick. It feels like an organic part of the arrangement, adding color and dimension without overwhelming the fundamental rock and roll structure. The song peaked at number 10 on the UK charts, giving Mott the Hoople their second consecutive top 10 hit and proving they could sustain commercial success beyond their initial Bowie-assisted breakthrough. More importantly, it established a template for the album that followed, which dealt with themes of rock and roll mythology, working class struggles, and the contradiction of trying to maintain artistic integrity within the commercial music industry. The influence of All the Way from Memphis extended beyond Mott the Hoople's immediate circle. Mott the Hoople was able, thanks to Hunter, to combine rock and roll mania of Jerry Lee, the Killer Lewis, and the lyrical insight of Bob Dylan. It's a fabulous slice of rock. In conclusion, All the Way from Memphis demonstrated that opening tracks could establish artistic credibility while remaining commercially viable, proving that 70s rock could have substance beneath its theatrical surface.
Let's talk about Achilles Last Stand. This is an unusual choice for an opening track. It's over 10 minutes long. And how did Led Zeppelin make that work, Mr. Meg?
Achilles Last Stand from Led Zeppelin's 1976 double album Presence represents Jimmy Page's definitive guitar symphony and the band's final truly great moment. After the experimental and sometimes indulgent sprawl of Physical Graffiti, which featured material recorded over several years and in various styles, Presence found Led Zeppelin focused and hungry in ways they hadn't been since their early albums. The circumstances surrounding the recording added urgency. Robert Plant had been seriously injured in a car accident and recorded his vocals while sitting in a wheelchair, unable to stand for extended periods. This physical limitation paradoxically resulted in some of his most powerful vocal performances, as if the pain and frustration channeled directly into the music. As an opening track, Achilles Last Stand made an audacious statement. Led Zeppelin wasn't going to ease you into this album with something radio-friendly or accessible. They were going to hit you with the hardest, most complex, most ambitious rock they'd created in 5 years. And if you couldn't handle it, that was your problem. The song opens with John Bonham's drums establishing a relentless driving rhythm that never lets up for the entire 10 minutes and 25 seconds. Then Page's guitar enters with a riff that sounds like ancient warfare being waged through Marshall amplifiers, aggressive and melodic simultaneously. What Page accomplished on this track remains staggering from a technical perspective. He layered multiple guitar parts. Some sources estimate between 6 and 8 separate guitar tracks, creating a dense interlocking web of riffs, counter melodies, and harmonic support that gave the song an orchestral quality without losing its essential heaviness. The interplay between Page's guitars and John Paul Jones's bass creates a foundation that's most muscular and nimble, capable of supporting Plant's vocals while maintaining enough complexity to reward close listening. Plant's lyrics reference Greek mythology, particularly the story of Achilles, mixing that classical imagery with more personal reflections on journeys and struggles. Lines like, "The mighty arms of Atlas hold the heavens from the earth," create this sense of mythological weight that matches the music's ambition. You get the feeling Plant is singing about both ancient heroes and contemporary struggles, using mythology as a lens through which to examine his own experiences recovering from a car accident and questioning whether Led Zeppelin could continue at their previous level. In conclusion, Achilles Last Stand proved that opening tracks could be epics rather than introductions, demanding significant investment from listeners while delivering a complete musical journey that justified every second of its extended runtime.
Mr. Meg, moving to The Who, Baba O'Reilly is one of the most recognizable opening tracks from the 70s. What made it so effective?
Baba O'Reilly from The Who's 1971 album, Who's Next, might feature the most iconic opening in rock history. That synthesizer pattern created by Pete Townshend that sounds simultaneously futuristic and primal, mechanical and human. For the first 30 seconds, you hear nothing but that repeating synth loop, establishing a hypnotic foundation that feels like a heartbeat of a machine gaining consciousness. Then the drums and guitars crash in with explosive force, and suddenly you're in the middle of one of the most exhilarating rock songs ever recorded. As an opening track, Bob O'Reilly accomplished multiple goals simultaneously. It introduced synthesizer technology as a central element of the Who's sound, moving them away from pure power trio dynamics towards something more expansive and experimental. It showcased each band member's instrumental prowess. John Entwistle's bass playing is melodic and aggressive. Keith Moon's drumming is controlled chaos. Townsend's guitar work is both rhythmic and melodic. And Roger Daltrey's vocals combine power with vulnerability. And it created an immediate emotional connection through lyrics that spoke to teenage frustration and the desire for escape, themes that had always been central to The Who's work, but were expressed here with the new maturity and sophistication. The song's title references two of Townsend's philosophical influences, Meyer Baba, the Indian spiritual master whose teaching Townsend followed, and Terry Riley, the minimalist composer whose repetitive structures influenced the synthesizer pattern. The lyrics work on a purely emotional level, capturing the feeling of being young and stuck, desperate for something more than the daily grind of work and school. The teenage wasteland line, which people often mistakenly believe is the song's title, became a generational slogan, a perfect encapsulation of youth's sense of potential being wasted by a society that doesn't value or understand them. The recording process for Bob O'Reilly represented a significant technical challenge. Synthesizers in 1971 were far less sophisticated than what we have today, and creating that repeating pattern required Townsend to program and record the synth separately, then have the band play along to it while maintaining perfect time. This was relatively novel for rock music at the time. Electronic repetition combined with human performance, merging the mechanical precision of technology with the emotional immediacy of rock and roll. The song reached only number 44 on the Billboard charts when released as a single in edited form, but its cultural impact far exceeded its commercial performance. In conclusion, Bob O'Reilly showed that opening tracks could embrace new technology without sacrificing rock and roll's essential human element, creating a template for how electronic songs and traditional rock instrumentation could enhance rather than compete with each other.
Mr. Merrick, Leonard or Skinner often gets pigeonholed as a straightforward Southern rock, but Saturday Night Special seems more complex than the reputation suggests. How did it work as an opening track?
Saturday Night Special from Lynyrd Skynyrd's 1975 album, Nothing Fancy, opens with one of the most menacing guitar riffs in Southern rock history, a descending pattern that sounds like danger approaching in slow motion. This wasn't the good time Southern rock of Sweet Home Alabama or the nostalgic narrative of Simple Man. This was Lynyrd Skynyrd at their darkest and heaviest, tackling gun violence with a moral complexity that separated them from the simple redneck character some critics tried to impose on them. The song argues against cheap handguns, the so-called Saturday Night Specials that were flooding American streets in the early 70s, creating deaths and bar fights and domestic disputes. But Ronnie Van Zant's lyrics don't preach or pontificate. They simply describe the consequences with stark imagery and let listeners draw their own conclusions. As an opening track for Nothing Fancy, Saturday Night Special immediately established a more serious, more mature tone than the band's previous albums. Lynyrd Skynyrd had achieved massive commercial success with their first two albums, especially the breakthrough single Sweet Home Alabama, but they didn't want to be locked into being the Southern rock party band. They wanted to prove they could tackle serious subjects without losing the musical power that made them popular in the first place. The instrumental performance on Saturday Night Special represents Lynyrd Skynyrd at their tightest. The three-guitar attack of Gary Rossington, Alan Collins, and Ed King creates a layered wall of sound that's both precise and aggressive. Each guitarist plays distinct parts that interlock to create the overall texture, a technique the band had been developing since their early days playing endless club gigs in Florida. The rhythm section of Leon Wilkerson on bass and Bob Burns on drums provides a foundation that's rock solid but never mechanical, maintaining the swing and groove that distinguish Southern rock from harder edge metal or punk. Van Zandt's vocal delivery on this track showcases his ability to sound conversational and commanding simultaneously. He's not shouting the message or overselling the emotion. The chorus, "Mr. Saturday Night Special, got a barrel that's blue and cold," personifies the weapon, making it seem almost alive, an active participant in violence rather than passive cool. It reached number 27 on the Billboard charts, a respectable performance for such an uncompromising track. The band's willingness to tackle controversial subjects while maintaining their hard rock foundation distinguished them from peers who either avoided politics entirely or approached it with less menace and nuance. In conclusion, Saturday Night Special proved that Southern rock opening tracks could combine crushing musical power with social commentary, challenging stereotypes about both the genre and the region while delivering one of the decade's most menacing performances.
Mr. Mike Pattismith Group's Gloria feels like it comes from a completely different universe than Southern Rock or Led Zeppelin. How did it function as the opening track?
Gloria, from Patti Smith's group's 1975 debut album, Horses, represents one of the most audacious opening tracks in rock history, beginning with spoken word poetry before transforming into a punk rock reimagining of them's 1965 guitar rock classic. Smith's opening declaration, describing Jesus and his relationship to rock and roll, immediately established that this wasn't going to be a conventional rock music. This was beat poetry colliding with CBGB punk attitude, Greenwich Village bohemianism channeled through three-chord primitivism, high art meeting low culture in ways that made both more vital. The genius of using Gloria as the musical foundation was that Smith took a song already embedded in rock and roll consciousness and completely transformed its meaning and emotional context. While Van Morrison's original with them was straightforward teenage lust barely disguised as romance, Smith's version spurned the narrative, changing the gender dynamics and adding layers of literary and spiritual reference that turned a simple rock song into something far more complex. As an opening track for Horses, Gloria announced several things simultaneously. Patti Smith was a serious poet who happened to be working in rock music. She was connected to rock history but willing to subvert it, and she wasn't interested in playing by anyone's rules about what female rockers were supposed to sound or be like. The production, handled by John Cale of the Velvet Underground, was deliberately raw and unpolished. Cale understood that Smith's power came from immediacy and authenticity, not studio perfection. Lenny Kaye's guitar work particularly embodied an aesthetic. His playing was more about texture and atmosphere than technical display, creating space for Smith's words rather than competing with them. The spoken word opening section set Smith apart from every other rock vocalist of the era. While Robert Plant was wailing about mythology and Mick Jagger was sneering through sexual innuendo, Smith was reciting poetry that referenced everything from French symbolism to street-level New York realism. This approach connected rock music to broader artistic traditions, suggesting that punk could be intellectual without being pretentious, that you could reference high culture while maintaining raw emotional power. The New York punk scene that Smith helped establish, alongside Television, Talking Heads, and the Ramones, valued this combination of artistic ambition and stripped-down musical approach. Smith's vocal delivery becomes more urgent and physical, demonstrating her range from contemplative recitation to raw rock shouting. This dynamic variation kept the 7.5-minute track from feeling monotonous, taking listeners on a journey from introspection to celebration. The track also demonstrated punk's relationship to rock history. Unlike some punk bands that rejected everything that came before, Smith embraced rock's past while twisting it into new shapes. She loved the Stones, the Doors, and Bob Dylan, but she approached their influence as raw material to be transformed rather than templates to be copied. In conclusion, Gloria showed that opening tracks could be radical artistic statements that challenged not just musical conventions, but cultural assumptions about poetry, gender, and what rock and roll could express when freed from commercial constraints.
Mr. Mick, let's end with something completely different. Steely Dan's Bodhisattva. How does his sophisticated jazz rock opener compare to the raw power of the other tracks we're discussing?
Bodhisattva from Steely Dan's 1973 album Countdown to Ecstasy represents the opposite end of the spectrum from punk primitivism. This is rock music for people who appreciated complex jazz harmonies, intricate arrangements, and instrumental virtuosity. The song opens with a guitar riff that sounds deceptively simple but contains sophisticated chord voicings, immediately establishing that Steely Dan operated on a different level of musical complexity than most rock bands. Donald Fagen and Walter Becker, the masterminds behind Steely Dan, were perfectionists who approached rock music with jazz musician sensibilities, valuing technical precision and harmonic sophistication without losing sight of creating songs that actually rocked. As an opening track, Bodhisattva served notice that Countdown to Ecstasy would be more adventurous and less commercially calculated than their debut album, Can't Buy a Thrill, which had given them a top 10 hit with a more accessible song about a radio station. This was Steely Dan embracing their jazz rock fusion tendencies, incorporating extended instrumental sections that showcased the ridiculous talent of the guitarist, Denny Diaz and Jeff Skunk Baxter. The guitar interplay between Diaz and Baxter on this track is extraordinary. They weave sound around each other, trading melodic ideas, creating counterpoint that boasts technical, stimulating, and viscerally exciting. This wasn't just technical showing off, it was musical conversation, two highly skilled players pushing each other to greater heights. The rhythm section of Fagen on keyboards, Walter Becker on bass, and Jim Hodder on drums provided a foundation that could shift from straight-ahead rock to more complex time signatures without calling attention to the transitions. This rhythmic flexibility gave Steely Dan enormous range. They could sound like a bar band one moment and a jazz combo the next, often within the same song. The title references Mahayana Buddhism's concept of enlightened beings who postpone their own transcendence to help others achieve enlightenment, suggesting that Fagen's lyrics were operating on a more intellectual level than typical rock fare. The words blend spiritual seeking with cynicism about American consumer culture, a combination that became Steely Dan's trademark approach. Fagen sings about someone seeking enlightenment, but struggling with the discipline required, a theme that resonated with 70s seekers who'd moved beyond 60s idealism but hadn't found satisfying alternatives. Lyrically, the song manages to be both reverent towards Eastern philosophy and skeptical about Americans' ability to genuinely engage with traditions they barely understand. This intellectual complexity distinguished Steely Dan from both the earnest spirituality of bands like Yes and the complete dismissal of anything transcendent by punk cynics. Commercially, Bodhisattva was never going to be a massive hit. It was too complex, too long, and too jazz-influenced for mainstream radio formats that preferred simpler structures. But as an album opener for a band targeting a more sophisticated audience, it worked perfectly. Countdown to Ecstasy reached number 35 on the Billboard album charts. And while that was lower than their debut, it established Steely Dan's artistic credibility. In conclusion, Bodhisattva demonstrated that opening tracks could showcase musical virtuosity and intellectual complexity without sacrificing rock and roll energy, proving that sophistication and excitement weren't mutually exclusive qualities.
So, Mr. Merrick, how do we sum up this look at the top opening tracks?
The opening tracks we've explored today represent the incredible diversity and ambition of 1970s rock music. From the Rolling Stones' controversial swagger to Patti Smith's punk poetry, from Led Zeppelin's epic guitar symphonies to Steely Dan's jazz rock sophistication, these songs announced their albums with authority and established moves that everything followed had to live up to. What united these disparate tracks was confidence. Each one believed absolutely in its own vision and refused to compromise or ease listeners into the experience. They kicked down doors rather than knock politely, demanding attention and rewarding it with some of the most vital music the decade produced. The art of the opening track has perhaps lost somewhat in the streaming era, when albums are no longer experienced as complete artistic statements and playlists replace carefully sequenced record sides. But these seven songs remind us what we've sacrificed, that sense of anticipation when dropping a needle on a new album, trusting that opening track would transport you somewhere worth going. In conclusion, Whether through raw power, sophisticated craftsmanship, or revolutionary attitude, these opening salvos from the 1970s remain as powerful today as when they first exploded from speakers half a century ago, proving that truly great music transcends its era to become timeless.
Indeed, and thank you, Mr. Mink, for sharing your knowledge and wisdom to the world. The 1970s rock album announces itself not with a gentle introduction, but with a declaration of intent. This was a decade where the opening track became an explosive art form, concentrated blast designed to seize the listener by the color and the define of the entire sonic journey to come. So, Mr. Mink, would you like to plug in something?
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Yes, connect with me on LinkedIn. Write the book, Grow the Business. G. Mick, the Doctor of Digital Smith, PhD. Also listen to a couple volumes. What I have on Amazon, On Track, Ian Hunter, and Burning America. And also listen to the Doctor of Digital podcast.
Yes, people, let's support Dr. Meg, the Dr. Digital. And please do listen to our baby podcast, Mental Health 101. Mental Health 101 is created to empower our mental health awareness. So, Mr. Meg, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, my friend. Until next time, Deus Vult.
Bodycon people, see you soon.